Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Whoa, okay. It fell down. All right, Reggie, how are you doing today? Feel like podcasting? Good, because we've got the studio. It's nice when that works out, when you feel like doing something that you're supposed to do. And I feel like it too, so we're on the same wavelength today. So let's not waste any time. All right, my friend, put it in the book. 477, 477 of these. Wow. All right, here we go. Instrument ready. Star, smile, strong. 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. Of course, listening is a great thing. Love when you listen to the podcast. Love it, love it, love it. But I got to tell you, a close second is getting out there and taking it to the streets, if you will. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Get them on board. Your loyalty and devotion are always, always appreciated. And talking about appreciation, if you like what you hear, whether you're a new listener or a longtime listener, you can always go back and hear where we've been so you know where we're going. Just log on to WGNRadio.com, go to the prompt for podcasts, and then hit the prompt for this specific podcast, and there you go. You will be welcomed with podcast after podcast after podcast. We've been doing this for 9 years, more than 9 years already. We're almost at 10 next May. And right now we're at 477, episode 477. It's not very often that you can pinpoint exactly where you were on a specific date in a specific year. Oh, sure. I mean, if you go on a vacation somewhere that was memorable, or a birthday, or there was some event, you know, a concert. If you got your concert ticket there, you've got the stub with the date and the time. I understand that. But if I throw out a random date to you, just seemingly random, would you be able to say, oh, yeah, I think I was at blah, 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 blah. This date that I'm going to throw out might be and seem relatively random, but then when you realize what happened, you go, oh, okay. And here's a chance for, actually, this is not just, a date that I could say I knew where I was. There's many listening today, I hope, I would assume, who could perhaps share in the same date. I'm giving you some valuable information here. I can tell you where I was on July 13th, 1985, exactly 40 years ago, almost to the day. This podcast posts on Monday, July 14th, so we're almost there. But I can tell you where I was. And if you're of a certain age and of a certain interest, I bet you were the same place at the same time. Ooh, that's deep. So let's see if we bond on this. Those of you who are old enough and cool enough. July 13th, 1985, 40 years ago. I know exactly what I was doing. I know exactly where I was. And I almost, through memory, can remember exactly how I felt. July 13th, 1985, was the event called Live Aid. Now, to some people listening today of a certain age, I would think if you're in your 50s and older, you'll remember it. Probably not when you, if you're 40, I don't think you'll remember it because you were just probably born. But I would think that if you were, say, if you're 50 years old and older, I think that you would remember it. I think that you've, there's a good chance you may have heard about it at least. And for all we know, you may have even watched it if you were really a cool 10-year-old. I mean, I was 9 years old, and that's when I became an Elton John fan. I've been buying records since I was about six. So if you were a hip, you know, even 8 or 9 year old or 10 year old, perhaps you were in this. So maybe we'll push it down to maybe, you know, if you're in your late 40s, early 50s. But I got to tell you, not only was it Live Aid a special event at its time, but now in retrospect, 40 years ago, when I look at the world of what's happened in those 40 years, especially today's world, where we are so divided and so fragmented and so distracted, and we have so few shared memories and shared events, I look back at July 13th, 1985, the Live Aid event, the global jukebox, if you will, a day when pop music and rock music regained its social conscience, looked out past itself, and found a very serious problem that is sadly still a problem, a horrible famine in Africa, especially in Ethiopia. And instead of sitting on its hands, rock and roll, which has always had something of a social conscience, dating back to its roots, even in the folk era, where the folk music slowly blended into the rock world from the 60s. Folk music was always very socially conscious. And as it blended into the rock world, as the artists like, say, Bob Dylan and Joan Baez and the Byrds and Peter, Paul, and Mary and things like that moved from folk into rock, they brought that social consciousness in with them and their activism into the rock world. And for a while, it was very strong. And then it's kind of faded away in the late 70s. But in the mid-80s, it came back in a big way. And my point is, when I look back at that event on that day, July 13th, 1985, it may have been one of the last, not the last, right? I mean, it's 40 years, but one of the last times when for just one day, the world, and once again, I'm being, you know, generalizing, but the world was on the same page for one day, for a certain amount of hours. Everybody was united. And today, of course, we're so divided. And we'll see how, I don't know if this, if the division that we have in this country can ever be, bridged anymore. It's so deep. And the sentiments on both sides are so strongly held that I don't know if we could ever be united. A lot of times we have been united in disaster or tragedy, things like 9/11, natural disasters, hurricanes, floods, tornadoes. That brings us together. But it's not very often that we're together for an optimistic and happy and positive occasion. You'd think that would be the norm, but it isn't. It certainly was the norm more in the past than it is now. You see films, footage of, and newsreels of, say, when World War II ended, and everybody filled Times Square, and of course that famous picture of the sailor kissing the girl. I mean, there are times when, yes, the world has rallied around one event in one day for a positive reason. But I'm looking at the last 40 years, and I even looked at the 4th of July this year. You know, next year is our 250th birthday, and I was around. I was a young kid, but I was around for the bicentennial, and that was one of those days. That was one of those days, but that was before Live Aid. But that was one of those days where everybody put aside whatever differences and divisions that they had to celebrate the country's birthday for its 200th birthday. But I look now and I saw how we celebrated our 249th birthday. And yes, there were celebrations and there were people gathering and people were celebrating, but there was also a lot of protest and a lot of antagonism and a lot of violence. And I wonder what the 250th birthday is going to be like. And when I saw that, I'm like, okay, here's an event, a holiday that, you know, it would seemingly would be a uniting thing. And yet it wasn't. And I only look and say, well, okay, on the 250, when there's really going to be a spotlight on it, those that are disenfranchised or disillusioned, I should say, they're going to be protesting instead of celebrating. And we love, you know, any kind of event with a zero or a five at the end, right? I've always say that. So I look back at 40 years ago, right around now, July 13th, and I remember, if you were of a certain age, don't get me wrong, like I said, you know, I doubt right now if your grandparents or your great-grandparents, perhaps. I know my mom and dad weren't sitting around the television with me watching Live Aid. They both passed away. But my point is, it wasn't everybody. I'm being a little general. But my point is, for a certain age group, it's a big age group and a big shared interest, it was a big day. It was a day that everybody kind of said, hey, did you see that? Did you see Live Aid? And everybody you spoke with, if you were of that certain age, all said yes. And I'm not being crazy, because this was a worldwide event. And according to the estimates, even back in those days when we didn't have the connectivity of the world that we have today, we certainly had satellite technology, which allowed us to, in many ways, cover the whole world, but not everything. But in today's world, with the internet and satellites and GPS things and all that stuff, our world is pretty much fully connected in many ways. We get internet in the most remote areas of the world now. But according to the estimates at the time, in 1985, after the event, 1.5 billion people watched. 1.5 billion people watched. So, no, it's not the whole world. At that time, I don't know, maybe there was 6-7 billion people in the world 40 years ago. We've got about 8 billion now. I'm not sure what the population was. But 1.5 billion people watching one thing, that's a pretty big number. So why was Live Aid so uniting? Was it the last time, or one of the last times, that we really united around one event? Especially when you look back what's happened over the last 40 years, and you look at the last 15 or 20, how we've become certainly more isolated, and we have less communal events. Live Aid was designed to be and was a communal event. And as much as it was possible, a global event, a global jukebox. It was a celebration, but it was also a purpose. And it was a huge humanitarian effort. It worked on many levels. It attracted people on many levels. So you hear the word Live Aid, and if you want to know more about it, right now CNN is doing a four-part series on Live Aid. Part one premiered yesterday on July 13th, the day of the event, but I'm sure they'll rerun it, and I think every Sunday they have a new episode. There'll be four episodes. I think they're about 2 hours apiece. So it should be a very comprehensive overview of what Live Aid is. But being someone that I wasn't there, unfortunately, but I can tell you that I watched all 16 hours. I was, what, in my late teens, early 20s? Totally into music, as I still am today. And so if you were into music, and if you were in your teens and older, and you were into rock music, there was no other event. And as I said, so many things came after that. It was a pivotal event for its time, and then what it represented and its influence later. So what the heck was this Live Aid? For those of you who may not remember or were too young to know, it really was an interesting time in the world. You know, in the 60s and 70s, protesting and humanitarian efforts and people looking around the world at the problems was a constant part of society. The youth, the counterculture, was looking around the world and around themselves and trying to, as they always said, change the world. And because rock and roll was around, popular music and rock and roll music quickly became entwined with that activism, as I said, beginning somewhat in the folk music world, because it was a lifestyle. If you were of a certain age in the 60s, you just listened to music. It was a part of your life. And as we see, so many of these heritage artists today in their 80s still commanding and filling up stadiums with 60 and 70,000 people, that was no joke. That was no fad. Music was important to those people 60 years ago when they were in their teens and their 20s, and when they're in their 70s and 80s, it's still important to them. That wasn't a fad. It wasn't just a youthful distraction or dalliance. It was a part of their lives. But, you know, this country especially and the world had some real tough times, and we can see that that's going on in today's world with wars and social problems. Sadly, if you look back 60, 70 years ago, many of the same things that we were dealing with and trying to solve, even though we've thrown billions and trillions of dollars at some of these problems, they still exist. We're still fighting the crime rate. We're still fighting poverty. We're still fighting housing. We're still fighting education. Those were still the main topics 50, 60, 70 years ago. And there was a lot of protest. There was a lot of activism starting because of the Vietnam War, going through then the early 70s with all these problems that I just mentioned, compounded by Watergate, Nixon's resignation, and then finally the end of the Vietnam War, which was a very dissatisfying end to a dissatisfying conflict. And it seemed as if people needed a rest. They were fighting and they were protesting and they didn't see much come from it. Many of these issues were never solved, and the ones that did end kind of ended with a dribble instead of a real impact. And a lot of that was also tied to the economy. The economy in the 70s was not good. When people seem to become much more looking into philanthropy and look outside themselves and look outside the world and see how they can help, majority of people are still concerned. We are still a nice species to each other, as much as it may not seem. We do care. We do want to help other people. But we do that many times. We look outside of ourselves when at least we feel some security within our own little world that we've carved out. And economics has a lot to do with that, especially when you're talking about donating money. If people feel secure in their own situation enough where they can fulfill their responsibilities of paying their bills, long-range responsibilities like for kids with college or things like that, and they can have a little spending money to go on a vacation or buy a car or a thing, if they feel good about themselves, and not just good, but at least secure in their situation, then yes, human beings will start to look and say, you know what? How can I help others? What problems are out there in the bigger world? And I don't think that's selfish. I think that's self-preservation. And the fact that they would look outside of themselves at any time is something optimistic to say about the human race. But I don't think it's selfish to say you first want to make sure that your situation is at least livable. And so what happened was a lot of that philanthropy took a back seat because the economics of the world were so tough for so many for so long. And even in the early 80s, when you think about the 80s, everybody thinks about Ronald Reagan and, oh, there was this great economic boom. But that's really not the case. The early years of the Reagan presidency, in fact, almost the whole first term, the economy was very difficult in the early 80s. It was only around 83 and 84 where all of a sudden there was an uptick. But it wasn't the entire decade. Everybody talks about, oh, the high-flying 80s. But in reality, there was an economic boom, no question about that. It probably started in late 83, certainly in 84, 85, 86. But then the stock market crashed in 1987. So while things were flying high for a while, it didn't last all that long. And then we were mired in more political scandals, Iran-Contra, and other things, and here we were. And we had a Gulf War. But for two or three years, and especially after the deep breath we took between the 60s and 70s with Vietnam and racial tensions and everything else, finally, around the mid-80s, we actually got a chance to say, hey, things feel good. The economy began to grow. People were getting jobs. People were working. And suddenly they had some extra money in their pockets. We saw the growth of you could also say it was a time of excess, of course. Maybe it was so long, the pent up. But, you know, that was the birth of the yuppie, the young urban professional, and the dink, two income, no kids, and the gentrification of a lot of cities where impoverished neighborhoods were being gentrified and buildings were being rehabbed and renovated. There was a lot going on, and people began to look outside themselves. They felt confident and somewhat secure in their own situation, and they said, you know what? I'm going to take the blinders off here and look at the bigger world now. I'm not going to be so isolated and worry about just me. I'm going to look at the bigger picture. So it's kind of a perfect storm. And amidst that, this kind of new vision of looking past in this kind of time of prosperity, if you will, Bob Geldof, who is and was the lead singer of a band called the Boomtown Rats, somewhat popular here in the United States in the late 70s and early 80s, kind of the post-punk, early new wave era. Most known for the song I Don't Like Mondays, which is still here. But Bob Geldof and the Boomtown Rats were huge in the UK during the late 70s and early 80s as the post-punk and new wave era was exploding in the UK. It didn't really make its way across the pond, across the Atlantic, until, say, 82 or 83 in a real way, and maybe even 84. And not coincidentally, it also made its way across because of the introduction of MTV, which I will talk about later, and I've talked about a past here on the podcast. In terms of the impact and the influence and the power that MTV had, certainly through the 80s and in through the 90s as well. It was a huge paradigm shift in terms of culture, pop culture, entertainment, music. It was huge. It was life-changing in many ways. It was culturally changing. And MTV plays a role in Live Aid. So in 1984, Bob Geldof, living in England, is watching a documentary on the BBC, which is like their major broadcast TV network. And there is a documentary about a horrible and horrific famine going on in Africa, in Ethiopia, caused by a variety of reasons, as many times these are. Not only were they naturally caused, but also corrupt governments, food not getting to people. But it was a horrific state of affairs. And in Britain, when this documentary showed, it really shook a lot of people. As I said, many of these stories around the world were not covered as much, and people were more worried and insulated in themselves. And then there was this new perspective of looking around and saying, hey, what's been going on since around everywhere else? And so this horrific famine that had been going on for many, many years was exposed. And Bob Geldof was so affected by this, being one in the rock world, also an activist, the punk, you know, don't forget the punk movement came out of an economic rebellion in England. The early punk days were young teenage boys, males, who were mad at the government. Anarchy in the UK, God Save the Queen, the Sex Pistols. It was all about horrible economic environments and opportunities for young people in high school and leaving high school not going to college. It was the economics and the social issues that gave rise to the rebellion of punk rock. And that's so that activism was already instilled in Bob Geldof. And given his stature in the UK, certainly more than in the United States, he decided to do something about it. And he saw this documentary and he said, how can we help these people? This is horrific. These young children and these families are literally dying because they don't have food. And we have this abundance of food around the world, but it's not getting to these people. And how do we do this? How do we address and help solve this problem and help save lives? As I said, in this new kind of perspective that people had now in the 80s, as we looked around and said, well, we're doing okay, but wow, there's some other people out there that are really suffering. How can we help them? And so Bob Geldof, very driven, very ambitious guy, kind of an FU guy, I'm going to get this done. Anybody who goes into the arts has that kind of view of the world, right? The odds against you making it, you have to have something of that in your nature. He got together with a friend, a fellow musician named Midge Ure, who was also in several groups, in popular groups in the UK, like punk and in new wave bands at that time, who still had not become big here. The new wave and punk never really took hold, the real hardcore punk that started in England. It came here, but it died quickly, and it was overtaken by disco in the late 80s. And it wasn't until, once again, the early to mid 80s when what was going on in England, the post-punk world and the new romantic and then the new wave, the synthesizer-based new wave kind of post-punk music, made its way across the Atlantic, mostly because of MTV, and I'll explain that. But he was in Ultravox at the time. So Bob Geldof got together with Midge Ure, and they said, well, and Bob Geldof's idea was, why don't we write a song and release it, and we will raise money from this song, and we will donate this money and give these people some help. And we'll write a song that's kind of an anthem and explains the situation, or at least pertains to the situation of why we're doing it. Now, this has happened before. There were charity songs and even charity concerts, George Harrison's concert for Bangladesh to raise money for the natural disasters that happened in that country in the early 70s. Bob Dylan, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, people like that. So it was anything new, but it just hadn't happened in a long time. Rock had not exerted, pop and rock music hadn't exerted its philanthropy in a long time. But Bob Geldof was inspired, and he had that activism in him. So they got together and they wrote this song. And this documentary was originally shown sometime in the later half of the year. And so Bob Geldof's idea was to put out this song at Christmas time. Now, you should know, in the UK, if you have a number one song on the Christmas chart, for whatever reason, I'm not sure why, but that's a big deal. Now, it's not necessarily a Christmas-oriented song. You could write a song about, heartbreak and whatever. It has nothing to do with Christmas. But if it's number one on December 25th, I guess maybe the last week of the year, whatever, I don't know. But that's a big deal. If you're in the UK and you have the number one song at Christmas, that's a big designation. And as I said before, it doesn't have to have anything to do with Christmas or Santa or anything else. Whatever the song's, topic or is about has nothing to do with it. But if it's number one at Christmas time, it's a big deal. And people would time a release of what they felt was a good song to get that Christmas number one in England. It's a big, big deal. So from Bob Geldof's view, well, why don't we release this song at Christmas time? It's when people are filled with goodwill and giving. So right off the bat, we're looking to raise money. At the same time, if we can be the number one single at Christmas single, that even helps the awareness. And this, the whole idea of this song is to bring awareness of this famine in Ethiopia and to get people to buy the record, to raise money so we can help these people. And so they came up with this song called Do They Know It's Christmas? And you may still hear it played at Christmas time, especially on those all Christmas radio stations. He put together a group of UK artists, mostly the up-and-coming UK artists of the time, as well as some of the well-established UK artists of the time. But this was very much a UK-based effort. That's where Geldof was from. That's where most of his musical friends were. And at the time, as I said, that's where the spotlight was on music at the time. There was the first British invasion in 1964 when the Beatles came over. But then British influence and the British music had taken a back seat for a long time. And suddenly, this new wave post-punk music was gaining traction, not only in the UK, but it was slowly coming over to America through import albums and then the growing acceptance and growing popularity of MTV. As I said, there was a lot of perfect storms going on at the time. So Geldof wrote this song, this anthem kind of song, Do They Know It's Christmas? Kind of ironic that meanwhile, while we're all celebrating the holidays, there's people in this part of the world who are suffering. And maybe we need to take a step back and realize that there are others in the world who are less fortunate. Isn't that part of the Christmas spirit? Isn't that the Scrooge story? So the timing was right. The cause was right. He put together this anthem song, this charity single. Now, of course, this whole idea of having, almost a chorus of high-profile celebrities singing a song is now kind of commonplace because of Do They Know It's Christmas? But this was groundbreaking at the time. And so Bob Geldof went out and put out feelers to some of his friends in the music business, and especially he was finding, and it was not only just some of his friends, but some of the up-and-coming artists in the British music world that were gaining a lot of popularity worldwide, wanted to take part. And so you had people like Boy George and Culture Club just beginning to gain international prestige and popularity. You had Bono and U2. You had members of Duran Duran, members of Spandau Ballet, George Michael and Wham, Paul Young. Many of the up and then established people like Sting and Phil Collins. But a lot of these people wanted to get involved. There was this new era of philanthropy, of helping others going on in the arts and in the culture overall. Once again, a perfect storm. And Bob Geldof himself has said that he was kind of surprised that so many big names were willing to come and help. He thought this might be a difficult job, but people had seen this, or they were informed about it, and they were all in. And so suddenly he had a huge group of well-known, popular British acts that would certainly bring attention to it in the UK and in Europe, and hopefully in the United States as well, to raise some money to help the people in Ethiopia going through this awful famine. So he called it Band Aid, which once again worked on several levels. There was this band and they were aiding people. They're also trying to put a Band-Aid on a serious problem. So it worked on a few levels. But Band-Aid's Do They Know It's Christmas was released in December of 1984. And it became a huge sensation in the UK. It was number one for 5 weeks. It was the Christmas number one. It did get play here. The video, there was a video with all those people. So you saw Simon Le Bon, and you saw Phil Collins, and you saw Sting, and you saw George Martin, and you saw Martin Kemp from Spandau Ballet, and Sting, and Boy George, and MTV played that video constantly. Huge, huge, heavy rotation. The song didn't get as much, wasn't number one here in America. But it certainly did its job in raising awareness of it. As I said, the British New Wave music still hadn't taken a strong hold here yet. So people, yes, they knew who Duran Duran and U2 in 1984 and 83 were, but it was still kind of niche-y. It wasn't the explosion that happened by 85 and 86, which I said, not coincidentally, had to do with the explosion of MTV's impact. And in many ways, MTV's profile and impact was risen by the role it played in July of 1985 with Live Aid. So, Do They Know It's Christmas becomes an international phenomenon, a big hit. It brings awareness to this cause, this famine in Ethiopia. It raises millions of dollars. Sadly, as a lot of times that happens with any kind of charitable thing, there's always questions about, is the money that's raised really getting to the cause? And there's been some of that surrounding the Live Aid and the Band-Aid thing through the years. Bob Geldof insists that the money has gotten there, but that's always sadly an outgrowth of that. But the fact was that they were raising money and they did get some money there and they were trying to help this cause. And given that the momentum of the song, Do They Know It's Christmas, had, Geldof, inspired by a comment by Boy George after he participated in the song and saw this the popularity, suggested, well, why not have a concert and really raise some money? And Bob Geldof apparently was having that idea, but the fact that Boy George had suggested as well convinced him that this wasn't just some pie-in-the-sky idea. And he found that the willingness for some of the top artists in the world to have taken part in the song originally now was only heightened because artists wanted to be a part of this now. It was cool. So not only were the original artists going to be involved in this concert, but now we're going to have other artists around the world who maybe didn't even know this existed, but now they say, wow, I want to be a part of that. I want to help people. It's good for my image, and I have a personal drive to help. And so it took several months, but the idea was to make this not just a concert, but an event, a global event. This was happening to people in our world. The idea was to raise a lot of money, and the best way to raise a lot of money was to get this issue and this event in front of as many eyes as possible around the world. No small task, but as I said before, Bob Geldof is the kind of guy that doesn't take no for an answer and has big, big ambitions and goes out on a limb if he has to. So after several months of planning, the idea was to not just have one concert, perhaps in the UK in a small little venue. No. They wanted to have a global event, as it's been described, a global jukebox, putting the music of the day, the artists of the day, the up-and-coming artists, as well as some of the legendary artists of the rock world, getting them involved, putting them on display, and using their talents to help some people that really need a life and death situation to be solved. It was the culmination of the rock music activism and social conscience that had been a part of the rock music world in the 60s and 70s, but as I said, had tapered off, and now there was a renaissance of it. And the idea was to make it happen in a big way. So it wasn't just one little concert in some 5,000-seat theater in England. It was filling Wembley Stadium, the biggest stadium in London, 60, 70,000 people, if not more. And also bringing it across the pond in America. America's the market. You got to get the Americans, especially if you want donations. And so, on July 13th, 1985, the plan was to have a 16-hour event with two simultaneous concerts, one in England and one happens in Philadelphia in JFK Stadium, where the at that time the Philadelphia Eagles played. The stadium now is gone. So big outdoor stadium, 60, 70,000 people on both sides of the Atlantic. And not only would it be a concert that would be for those who attended, but it would be broadcast around the world. Satellite technology throughout several, many countries, Russia, you name it. As much as the world could be connected at that time, that was the goal. This was a pre-internet, pre-GPS world, but we still had satellite technology. And one of the main conduits, not only in the United States, was it were like 3 or 4 hours of the show, especially the American part, which was later in the day, obviously, because of the time difference, on ABC Network, a major network. So it was shown for everybody to see. But, and this is so key, MTV. This was right in their wheelhouse. Music television, 24 hours on cable. They were all the artists and all the music and all the videos that they had been talking about and promoting and saying how cool all this stuff was all going to happen in this 16-hour two-country event. It was made for MTV, and they were there to broadcast it. On July 13th, 1985, I was in front of my television watching MTV, like so many other people. And after that event was over, MTV's influence, popularity, and overall cultural importance just skyrocketed. And a huge shift happened after that. MTV became the star maker for music for the next 15 years, if not more. It was always radio airplay. And even in the early days of MTV, radio didn't really reflect what was happening on MTV. It was like it was a niche little thing. But after Live Aid, MTV showed its power, showed its potential, and that's where people went to listen to new music and find new music and hear new music. It used to be radio for young kids, but not anymore. And the visual aspect certainly played a part in that. And MTV was the source for most people to watch that entire event. It was, as I said, on ABC here in the United States. It was on ITV in the UK. But for most people, we watched it on MTV. And after that, we were watching and we wanted our MTV for many, many years afterwards. It became a musical and cultural force. It was, I remember just being so excited because this was my music. And here it was. It was being exalted. Rock had always been viewed, even though as rock and roll music became popular in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even in the early 80s, it was still viewed as a niche. It still was not the established music now of the culture. People like Frank Sinatra and the old guard were still around. But Live Aid changed all that. It really did. It put the new up-and-coming bands and artists of the time on this world stage, and it also put some of the legends of the 60s and 70s back on the world stage to remind people just how good they were. It was a great day for music. It was a great day for rock. It was a great day for philanthropy and humanitarianism. It was the 60s vibe 20 years later, in a big, big way. As I said, there were these benefit concerts and things like that, but they were still viewed as not internationally recognized things, but Live Aid put rock and roll into the culture for good. It had been around, for 30 years, but Live Aid dug it deep. It really was a paradigm and cultural shift on July 13th, 1985. And I just remember watching it from the first minute to the last, and I was just in heaven. Because, as I said, not only was it filled with so many of the bands that I was now getting into, some of the newer bands, but also it had many of the legendary bands of the last 30 or 40 years as well. So the idea was to have these two concerts happening at Wembley and in Philadelphia, broadcast live, 16 hours. And there were some historic, memorable events and moments from that. Probably most people know of Live Aid for one reason and one word: Queen. You have to understand, I know it's hard, especially for some younger people, to think that Queen, who now is held in such high regard, but in 1985, Queen was not that popular anymore. They had some major hits in the mid to late 70s and even in the early 80s with little Crazy Little Thing Called Love and stuff like that. But by 1985, they were viewed as the old guard. And while they were still British, they were considered an old band. And as I said before, in the UK, it was Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet. And the Police, of course, had been around, but they were huge. And Dire Straits and people like that. You know, Culture Club. This was a whole new era, this new age, new wave, kind of post-punk era. Queen was viewed as the old guard, even though they weren't that old. But, you know, it's always been a youth culture. Queen didn't even have a really good slot in the overall lineup. If you watch the footage, which was also, of course, recreated in the film Bohemian Rhapsody, which really put Freddie Mercury and Queen into another level, they never were as popular. Queen was never as popular in their heyday as they are today. And it's all because of Live Aid, and then later because of the movie that reminded people again. But Live Aid, Freddie Mercury came for bear. Freddie Mercury came to prove that he was not yesterday's news, that he was not the old guard, that he was as relevant today as he ever was, even though the band wasn't as popular. And there were all these young guys like Bono and U2 and all these other bands, you know, the cool hip bands. But on that day, nobody was cooler, nobody was hipper, and nobody was better than Freddie Mercury and Queen. And he went out there to prove that. As I said, they had him in the afternoon. It was still light out. If you look at the footage, either you go on YouTube and watch it, or you see the recreation of it in the film, what you really can do, there's a great three or four CD or a DVD set that has the entire Live Aid concert on. I've got it. It's great. And if you really want to know about Live Aid, you need to see that. But you can go on YouTube and look up specific things. 21 minutes is what Queen had. And they stole a 16. In those 21 minutes stole the 16-hour event. Think about that. Freddie Mercury was focused and determined to prove to the world, on this world stage, that they weren't some old guys and some yesterday's news. And the interaction between Freddie Mercury and the crowd, when you watch that, and I remember watching it live and going, wow. I mean, the crowd was in perfect sync with at Wembley, in perfect sync with Freddie Mercury. And he was strutting and performing and singing his heart out, and it was one of those synergistic moments when artist and audience just bond, and it was a sight to see. So much so that we now find later on that many of the artists had to follow Queen And these were heavy hitters like David Bowie and The Who and Elton John and Paul McCartney were like, whoa, how are we going to follow that? Huge, huge moment in rock history happened at Live Aid at Freddie Mercury and Queen's performance. Also, you know, I feel sorry for Phil Collins because over the last 20 or 30 years, he's been getting a bad rap. But in the mid-80s, he was one of the biggest stars in the world, bar none. He got ragged on in the late 90s and early 2000s by the guys who do South Park because he beat them for an Oscar, and they just started to attack him on South Park, and South Park was the cool hip show at the time. And so people that really didn't know or care and wanted to be cool sort of fell into this Phil Collins bashing, and I feel sorry for him because not only is he a great musician and has written some of the greatest songs in the rock era, but it kind of denigrated his legacy. Phil Collins was huge. Phil Collins was one of the biggest stars in the world, not only as a solo artist, but as the drummer for Genesis. So much so that he was the only artist to appear at both concerts on that same day. He played drums during Sting's set at Wembley and then jumped on, and some people may not even know what this is, jumped on a Concorde supersonic jet. We don't even have them anymore, sadly. But these were commercial jets that made the 6 or 7 hour flight from New York to London in 3 hours. And because of the Concorde and its ability, Phil Collins played early during the Wembley set. And don't forget, there's a time difference. He got on a plane, flew to the East Coast, Philadelphia, and then played at the Philadelphia concert. He played with Sting, got on the Concorde, flew across the Atlantic, got to the stadium, and played a solo set, played drums for Eric Clapton because he had just produced and played on his solo album, Behind the Sun. And then he actually played drums for a reunited Led Zeppelin, who hadn't played since they broke up in 1980 with the death of John Bonham. Didn't have a drummer, but they had one on that day. That should have been one of the high points of Live Aid as well, the reunion of Led Zeppelin. Unfortunately, they hadn't really played in a long time. They hadn't rehearsed, and the set was not as exciting as you would have hoped. A Led Zeppelin reunion at the time was big, big expectation. But sadly, it wasn't in execution what we had all hoped. But it was still cool to see Robert Plant and Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones together on a stage. So Live Aid had its moments too. But here's just some of the acts who played. Like in Wembley, for instance, there was Style Council, was Paul Weller's band after the Jam. The Boomtown Rats, as I said before, that was Bob Geldof's band. Adam Ant, which was a big star in the late 70s and early 80s in England with kind of the New Romantics movement just before Live Aid. Ultravox, as I said, Midge Ure's band. Spandau Ballet that was big. Elvis Costello, Nick Kershaw, who had some big hits in the 80s. Chardet, as I said before, Sting. Howard Jones. Paul Young, U2. Dire Straits, Queen, David Bowie, The Who, Elton John, and Paul McCartney. And then, of course, the show ended with everyone who played to come back on and sing Do They Know It's Christmas, even though it was July. So that was the Wembley lineup. Not a bad lineup for a concert. On the United States side, then, it started at noon in England, which here was, you know, the show here started later so that one would be happening and then there would be a little overlap and then the other one would go through the night. And they did for the first time, they even had to figure out how can we get, I mean, there was never really a stop in the music. That's the other thing. You know, all these bands had all of their equipment. It wasn't just like one set of drums. So they had a revolving stage of for equipment. So there was never a break in the action. It was very quick. They had a revolving like setup where as one band was playing, behind them they were setting up the drum kits and everything else so that when that band finished, it was like on a turntable and the stage, the staging for the at least for the you know, the instruments and everything, turned like a Lazy Susan, like on a turntable, and then the new band was ready to come out. So there wasn't like 20 minutes in between bands. This was boom, boom, boom. That's the other thing that was so cool about it. It was 16 hours of constant music. It was like any, it was like it was unlike anything that ever happened before. It was such a thrill and so cool to be watching this. So the United States side, once again, to play into the activism part, as I said before, of folk rock, the United States side concert was started by Joan Baez, who came from the, you know, from the folk rock world, obviously. And then there was the Hooters, who were a very popular band. I think they were actually from Philadelphia at the time in the 80s. The Four Tops, a classic Motown group. Billy Ocean, Run DMC, Black Sabbath, Rick Springfield. Yeah, Jesse's Girl. Rick Springfield played at Live Aid. He was that popular in the 80s. REO Speedwagon, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Judas Priest, Brian Adams, The Beach Boys, George Thorogood and the Destroyers. Good, good for good old George. The Pretenders. Who else we got here? Tom Petty, Madonna. The Cars, the Thompson Twins, Power Station, as I said, the Led Zeppelin reunion, Eric Clapton with Phil Collins, Neil Young with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Hall and Oates. I mean, you just you know, Duran Duran, you name it, and it was ended by Bob Dylan, once again, the sort of a voice of a generation. From that folk world, as I said before, who was backed by Keith Richards and Ronnie Wood. Oh, I forgot to say, Mick Jagger and Tina Turner singing together. I mean, this was rock royalty on parade on both sides of the Atlantic. And what was ironic, what happened when Bob Dylan came out to play was he came out to play to end the American side of it, and he made a comment before he started playing that said, you know, it's great to be raising this money, but maybe you can take a couple of million and give it to some of the farmers in the United States who are losing their farms, because as I said before, the economic times were not that great for many people still in the country, so especially farmers. And Bob Geldof was not happy when Bob Dylan made that comment to this worldwide audience, because Bob Geldof was like, hey, I'm trying to raise money for this international cause in Ethiopia. And in your side of, you're sort of, you know, hijacking my event with this other issue. It's an important issue, but not today. So, but Bob Dylan is Bob Dylan, and Bob Dylan, you know, he does whatever he wants. And even though there was some acrimony between Geldof and Dylan for saying that, and there wasn't any of the money used from the Live Aid event to go to farmers. But Bob Dylan's comment on that world stage did wind up influencing a cause for the American farmers. Because Willie Nelson was watching the show that night, and he heard Bob Dylan's comment. And, of course, Willie Nelson, country artist, a big rural following, said, well, wait a minute, if they could put on an event like this to help people in Africa, why can't we put on an event like this to help some of the people in our own country, just like Bob Dylan said? And that was the birth of Farm Aid, which is still around today, which still has concerts today and has one practically every year since 1985. And while I wasn't at Live Aid, I can say that I was at the inaugural version of Farm Aid that was held at Champaign-Urbana, the University of Illinois. I didn't get to Live Aid, but a few months later in October of that same year, of 85, I was at Farm Aid, the first Farm Aid, which was put together by Neil Young, who also played at Live Aid, John Mellencamp, and of course Willie Nelson. And now other people like Sheryl Crow and Dave Matthews and others are involved. But those three were the original founders of Farm Aid. And then through the years, there were other aids. There were people, then for the homeless, there was Comic Relief. Live Aid inspired a whole new philanthropy in the entertainment world. It became a cause within a cause. People wanted to help other people. As I said, in this time of economic prospering for a short time in the 80s, people were starting to look outside themselves. And so, like I said, we had Farm Aid and we had Comic Relief for the homeless. At the same time, Steve Van Zandt also got involved with apartheid in South Africa, put together his Sun City single that brought attention to the apartheid system and the segregation of South Africa. So a lot of renewed philanthropy and social activism started in the mid-80s, and it started because of Do They Know It's Christmas? And then culminated with the social, the musical, and the humanitarian moment of the impact of Live Aid. It was really a once-in-a-lifetime event. And if you were lucky enough to have been watching it, if you were lucky enough to have been at one of those concerts, well, that must have been cool. But it really was a day where it seemed like for a few hours, 16 hours, a pretty long part of the day, the world was united, at least for a little time. And I just, I wish we could get back to that time because it was really unique. And ironically, what's also interesting about Live Aid are some of the people that weren't there. Bruce Springsteen was invited. In fact, the date was even pushed back to accommodate him. But apparently he regrets not going and said he didn't think how big of it was going to be. Nobody really knew how this was going to work out. Yes, the lineup was there. Yes, the technology was there. Yes, they had this staging thing, but nobody knew, was this going to be a failure or a success? But from the first minute, it was a success. But this was a new idea. And so people like Springsteen didn't show up, turned it down. Michael Jackson, the biggest star of the world in that time, was invited. Didn't show up. Prince, another huge star at the time, after his Purple Rain film and album and tour, did not do it. Huey Lewis, one of the biggest bands in the world at the time, didn't do it. Ironically, Boy George, who suggested to Bob Geldof to do a concert based on the success of Do They Know It's Christmas?, then did not take part in the concert. And his bandmates were very unhappy about it. But he was concerned that the money wasn't going to the right places and all this other stuff. And Culture Club was not a part of that concert. But it really was a unique event. For those of us who watched it and were a part of it. And hey, I didn't have a lot of money there. I just had my little job at Juul at the time. I was still in college. But I donated $20 and I still have my Live Aid lapel pin. You know I love lapel pins. You know I love brooches. I donated my $20 and they sent me my little Live Aid pin, which I still have. A great memory of that 40 years ago. It was a cool time. It was a prosperous time in the world. There was optimism. There was activism. There was humanitarianism and philanthropy. And it really was a cultural shift. As I said before, after that, MTV skyrocketed into popularity and influence. The new wave bands of that time, many of these bands that were on this bill, just exploded. Even more, Thompson Twins, Duran Duran throughout the middle, the mid and late 80s, as well as many of the established stars. Like I said, David Bowie had a you know, a revival with his Let's Dance album in 83. Dire Straits with their Brothers in Arms album. Right at that time, they were one of the biggest bands in the world. U2 became stars that day. Bono was climbing in the rafters and amongst in a typical Bono look at me moment, climbing up with the cords on the sides of the stage and trying to get out into the crowd. The U2 performance is also memorable. I think they did an 11-minute version of the song Bad. If not for Queen, most likely people would have been talking about the U2 performance. But certainly that performance put U2 on the map. And a year or so later, they dominated the world with the Joshua Tree. So it was a huge event for its moment. And let's not forget, not only did it inspire other causes for other problems, but without Do They Know It's Christmas and without Live Aid, we also don't have USA for Africa's We Are the World. Because what happened was, here's this group of British artists who are helping people in Africa. Meanwhile, many of the African Americans here in the United States, especially activists and entertainers, most prominently Harry Belafonte, who was a well-known singer and actor. Dayo. He was had been an activist. He was with Martin Luther King during the marches, and he turned to many of the African American artists and said, "Well, wait a minute. Why are these British people helping people in Africa? These people are our people. Many of us were descended and have roots in Africa. We should be helping this famine. It's great that Bob Geldof and these British people are helping and these, but what about we should be helping our people as well in this new era of philanthropy? Let's go." And so he got Michael Jackson then, who didn't take part in Live Aid, to write a song with Lionel Richie, which of course became We Are the World, and then that became the USA for Africa song, We Are the World, which then raised more money and brought more attention and had another all-star cast. And some of those people that were not involved in the Live Aid did get involved in USA for Africa, including Bruce Springsteen, including Huey Lewis. But then we had some of the great American artists of all time, both young and old. So we had Cyndi Lauper's amongst and Huey Lewis's and amongst people like Ray Charles and Diana Ross and Bob Dylan. You know, we had, you know, and Paul Simon, and I'm just going off the top of my head here. But so without Live Aid, a lot of that was not even in the thought process. Bob Geldof wound up getting knighted for his work. It was a gargantuan effort. It was pulled off. The Live Aid Band Aid Foundation is still funneling money to help underprivileged people throughout Africa. But on that day, Live Aid, I think, was one of the last times, certainly one of the more memorable times, when the world was at one place experiencing the same thing. We have so few communal shared moments anymore. But that one is one that I clearly remember. I'm grateful that I was around for it. I was a little too young for Woodstock. But this was kind of, you know, that generation's Woodstock. And the biggest regret and saddest regret is one person wasn't there. Not because he didn't want to be, because he was taken away. And I truly believe that if John Lennon was not assassinated in 1980, for all we know, because he was such an activist and he was so worried about peace and those in peril around the world, and he and Yoko in the late 60s and early 70s were constantly out raising money, doing concerts, appearing, protesting for different causes around the world, most notably the Vietnam War. In fact, he was so impactful that at the time, Richard Nixon, the president, was trying to deport John Lennon because the government was so afraid of his influence and the impact he was having on influencing young people in this country against the Vietnam War that they tried to deport John Lennon. For about 3 or 4 years, he was on eggshells whether he could live here. Finally, his case was dropped in 1976. But for several years, he was living under the threat of being deported because of his activism and the impact that he had. And so, sadly, in 1980, just as he had returned to the music world after taking about 5 years off from 75 to 80 to help raise his baby son, Sean, he came back in 1980 with a Double Fantasy album, and he was back. He was driven. He was inspired. He already had another album in the can. The plans were to have a tour in 1981, and I would not have been surprised that even before Live Aid and before Do They Know It's Christmas in 1984, I wouldn't have been surprised with John Lennon back in the game, completely reinvigorated, completely re-inspired. I wouldn't be surprised if some kind of a Live Aid event or song wouldn't have even have happened before in 1985, put together by John, because he did charity events and charity singles as well long before, back in the 70s, long before it was cool. But even if he hadn't, and maybe if he wasn't aware of this famine, but after Geldof did this, I guarantee you that John Lennon would have been a part of Live Aid in some way, if not on that single, Do They Know It's Christmas. I have every belief he would have been a part of Live Aid and Band Aid in some way. If he hadn't started something of his own before that, he certainly would have been a part of this. And I honestly believe that if John Lennon was alive, Live Aid was such a major moment in rock's evolution and its permanency at the time. And as I said, it's shifting of becoming the established music of the moment. Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin and all those were gone now. Yes, they were around for a while, but Live Aid established rock as the music of the time. It was no more a fad. And who was more responsible than that than the Beatles and John Lennon establishing that in 1964 to say, move over, Beethoven. So I think if John hadn't started something on his own before 1985, since he came back into the music world, and his activism, I'm sure, would have been just as heightened as it was when he started and mixing it with his new music, he certainly wouldn't have been a part of Band Aid and Live Aid. And I really believe that because this was such a worldwide event and it was a humanitarian event and it just had all the right intentions, I believe that the Beatles would have reunited for Live Aid. I believe they would have been on the stage at Wembley, and that would have been even more historic than anyone could have thought. The Beatles had broken up in 1970, and 15 years later, I guarantee you, if John Lennon was alive, I believe the Beatles, even if it was just for one day, for one song, I believe the Beatles would have reunited with John Lennon back in the music world. And this event, which certainly, if he hadn't planned it, his spirit and his influence was embedded in it. He was rock's philanthropist. He was rock's activist, much more than Bob Dylan. While Bob Dylan was called the voice of the generation, he stepped away from that. But Lennon stepped into the ring and into the arena and became a very active participant in his activism and putting a social conscience to rock and roll in the 60s and 70s. So I have no doubt that he would have been a part of Live Aid, and I have no doubt that he and the Beatles would have reunited for Live Aid. And oh my gosh, if you think the Queen performance would have been something, to have the Beatles at Wembley together for the first time in 15 years, wow, I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about it. And I guaranteed that would have happened. And we, unfortunately, were denied that by Mark David Chapman, who I am still so angry about John Lennon's death and assassination. What that guy took away from the world, the spirit and the art and the influence and the humor and the humanity of John Lennon, and Mark David Chapman took that away from the world and really deprived us of so much that could have happened and so much good that could have happened. And I really believe, because you have to remember too, in the mid-80s, it might be hard for people to understand, but in the mid-80s, the Beatles music was not as popular as it is today, certainly. There's been some great marketing in the last 25 years to get the Beatles music known to another generation. The fact that Ringo and Paul are still around and still touring certainly helps. But in the 80s, the Beatles even individually had faded. The Beatles music was still popular, don't get me wrong. But the second British invasion was happening. And as I said before, the Beatles were viewed as the old guard. And by the mid-80s, Paul McCartney's solo career wasn't as hot as it was in the mid to late 70s. George Harrison wasn't. Ringo Starr wasn't. And John was gone. So that would have even been more powerful, because these conquering heroes would have come back and showed everyone, here's what it's all about. It would have been a spine-tingling moment. I know that the Beatles would have reunited for Live Aid. We can only imagine what that would have been. Pun intended. July 13th, 1985, Live Aid. On July 14th, 2025, in a world that is very divided, very segmented, very discombobulated is the word. But 40 years ago, for one day at least, the world really came together. There was a new moment. Rock and roll took its place. MTV changed the culture. And for the first time in a long time, philanthropy overall was getting popular again. It was a very special moment. It was the last time, I think, in many, many years since, that we all were together enjoying one thing and feeling the same way in a positive way. Live Aid. If you don't know about it, go find out about it. If you were lucky enough to have been watching it or to have been there, remember it with a smile. It was a great day. It was a cool day. It was a musical day. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNradio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 477. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. From the end of my mind to your ears. Do they know it's Christmas?